Welcome, dear listener, to Let's Dig Deeper, the podcast where we talk all about archaeology, history, art, and culture. My name is Zinat Haroun. I am a student of classical archaeology here at the University of Copenhagen. And in this podcast, I'm going to take you along for interviews with some of the delightful people working in the field. We're talking archaeologists, historians, researchers, and professionals. And hopefully, we'll learn more about the past in the process. And today, I'm joined by the amazing Christian Amitsbøl-Thomsen. Welcome to the studio, Christian.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Christian, you are a professor of world culture at the National Museum of Denmark, where your interest lies in history, ancient Greece, and democracy, to name a few. You have a PhD in history from this university, the University of Copenhagen, where you were also a lecturer for several years. And you've recently published a book called Voices from Antiquity, or Stemmer fra Antiken, in which you highlight those people who are not given the spotlight as often, so women, slaves, and foreigners in basic terms. And today's topic is democracy in antiquity. Specifically, the democracy that we most often think of, namely the one in ancient Athens. And before we dig into it, let's start off with a super short intro to Athenian democracy in general. I mean, Athens is often called the cradle of democracy. So can you give us a definition of the word democracy and what it roughly would have meant for ancient Athenians?
Right. First off, it's maybe important to distinguish between democracy that we know of and demokratia, which is what the ancient Greeks called it. Of course, the two are related. The words are related, the ideas are related, but they're different things. So ancient democracy was a form of government in which all male citizens participated in running their state, their city-state. So it's a kind of a direct democracy in which everyone takes part. Aristotle famously says that everyone rules and are ruled in turn. Whether actually everybody did participate or to what extent everybody participated is, of course, a different question, but it's at least one that allowed for all adult male citizens to take part in government.
All right, so thank you for that introduction. Now let's dig deeper. And Christian, democracy is the most famous political system when you think of Athens. I think we can agree on that. But what was the political system like in Athens before democracy?
Yeah, so before democracy, for many years, Athens, like so many other ancient Greek city-states in what we call the Archaic period, which is approximately 650 BCE until around, the beginning of the 5th century, Athens had a tyranny. Tyranny in this context means simply just a one-person rule. The word tyranny at this point did not necessarily have the sort of ominous connotations that we associated with tyranny today, but it meant one person ruling. Athens for a long time was under the rule of Pisistratus and eventually his sons. However, when Pisistratus died and his sons took over, there were other members of the Athenian elite who thought that that might be a very good job and wanted to be part of ruling their city-state. And so in the lead up till the introduction of democracy in Athens, there was kind of an oligarchy of wealthy families vying for power in the absence of Pisistratus and when his sons were ruling.
And when did democracy then first transpire?
I guess it depends on exactly what you mean by democracy, but the conventional date that we use is the year 5087 BCE. We say 5087 because the year in ancient Greece began in the summertime, and so we can't map them directly onto our own year. So it's in the year, last half of the year 508 and early half of 507 BCE. That's the year when Cleisthenes, a member of this Athenian elite, got sick and tired of the intra-elite competition and, as some of our sources say, took the people or the demos into his heteraia. He put them into his political club, and so extended political power also to the masses, again the adult male citizen masses, and founded a new kind of system, which was eventually going to be known as demokratia or democracy.
And what events led to the then expansion of democracy? I mean, we know of events like the Persian Wars that might have played a role in it.
Yeah, so for a long time in the 5th century, at least 5th and 4th centuries BC, democracy was only one form of government. And again, it might come in different shapes and sizes from various Greek city-states. We have to bear in mind that there are, at this point, approximately 900 different Greek city-states. Some of them are democracies and some of them are oligarchies. And at this point in Greek history, these are two kinds of different ideologies competing, but also they're part of a game in which, a sinister game of domination between the city-states, in which one city-state might support the democratic or oligarchic faction in another city-state, actually not so much for ideological reasons, but as a means of taking over that city-state or throwing their influence influence around. John Ma, a colleague of ours in the University of Columbia, has just last year published a book that trails the whole of Greek history. And he calls this period of the 5th and 4th century for the Hundred Years' War, borrowing from another historical time period. But what he means is that there's this competition between city-states, and the sort of struggle between democracy and oligarchy should be seen in that light. Now, that's not what you asked, but short answer to the question is that eventually, after Alexander conquers the Greek world, well, his father conquers the Greek world, he conquers the rest of the world, as it were, the known world at the time, a new sort of like system is imposed on the Greek world in which kingdoms sort of like rule areas of Greek city-states and try to ensure that there is stability. So under that sort of umbrella of geopolitical domination by the kingdoms, democracy emerges as the only viable form of government. And within a generation or two, almost all Greek city-states have democracy. We can explain why there's stability. We cannot explain at the moment why there is democracy, but I'm hoping to lead a new research project on that in the future, find out exactly what it is about democracy that is so interesting for all the Greek city-states.
And if we turn our gaze back to Athens itself, there were these actual places in the city where democracy would, happen, as you could say. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the Pnyx, which was this area sort of a little bit outside of town where people would gather. And what was the function of the Pnyx?
So the Pnyx is a hill in Athens, and you can go there today, and you come up from the city and you can look onto the Acropolis from there. So the Pnyx is the gathering point for the Athenian democracy, for the assemblies, the people's assemblies in classical Athens. So that's where all adult male citizens, again, have access to go and vote on whatever motions are being made for new laws and decrees. And so they gather there. Eventually, as time passes, the place is monumentalized. It's built into a proper meeting place. It used to be just like just a hill, but then it's given a new shape that allows for better listening to the person speaking and so on. So it's kind of monumentalized as things progress. Interestingly, it'll only fit 6,000 people. But we think that for some periods, there were at least 10 times as many adult male citizens in Athens. So when I said before that everyone can participate, there's also kind of the expectation that not everyone will. And that's the kind of accommodation that's needed or that is enough for democracy to function, which is interesting in many ways.
You've sort of already talked a little bit about the limitations of democracy, and ancient Athenian democracy was maybe actually a far cry from democracy that many countries have today. For example, as you've said, citizen was a term with a very narrow definition. You had to be a free adult male, and so slaves, children, women, and foreigners weren't deemed as citizens. And so did they have no say in democratic proceedings at all?
They had no say, no formal say, of course. They're excluded in the Greek perception of this. It's just the natural state of things. Like the struggle between democracy and oligarchy is only about the expansion of political rights within the group of adult male citizens. So everybody else is excluded. And there are comedies, obviously, from classical Athens from the late 5th century that toy around with the idea of women having political rights. And it's an interesting kind of source material to work with, because on the one hand, it's clear that it's the stuff of comedy, right? It's hilarious, the very idea that women would have political rights. On the other hand, it also presents kind of what seems like women's perspective on this exclusion. So it's not a simple thing. But this is where democracy in the ancient world and democracy in the modern world, well, we should say in the very modern world, because until, I suppose, the early 20th century, women were also excluded of our modern democracies. Going back into the 19th century, some of modern democracies endorsed slavery. So it's really a distinction, not so much between ancient and modern democracy as between our contemporary democracy and more distant democracy.
And in your new book, Voices from Antiquity, you present these fragments from the ancient world where you highlight these usually unheard voices. For example, one of the highlights is about a slave woman writing to her master that she doesn't want to escape from his oversight. And in this, you give her a sort of power over him. But I think this can be up for some debate. I mean, I think most would agree that a slave woman did not hold much power over her master, and that by all accounts, her life was probably very hard. But when you work with fragmentary sources, there's always this risk of overinterpreting. And how did you navigate between giving a voice to the unheard while also avoiding projecting modern ideas onto the past?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first of all, I think it's important to just register that when we work with history, and we work with ancient history in particular, we don't necessarily work with absolute truth. We work with degrees of probability. And so I hope that, I mean, that was my intention at least, to also highlight exactly how sure I am about different conclusions. But in that case, I feel pretty confident about my interpretation there. So I'll put that in the highly plausible end of the spectrum. So it's really, because I would share that view of enslaved people in the ancient world, and I suppose in any other period as well. Because of course, formally, they are, you know, completely without rights, and they're regarded as property and not even as people. But they are also people, right? Even though the law doesn't say that they are. And I think that fragment kind of highlights that there's an interpersonal connection which exists alongside and interwoven with the institution of slavery. So she is not given any power at all. But I kind of detect in this fragment that she thinks that she has options, right? That she has a way, that she has possibilities of influencing her master. And originally, the bafflement, you brought it up, right? That she writes to him that she doesn't want to run away, kind of hinting that she could. So that raises the question, why didn't she, right? And I arrive at the interpretation that probably life as an escaped slave is not an easy life either, right? And so that she feels that her options are probably better in kind of manipulating him a little bit. That doesn't mean that she's free, footloose, and happy and can do whatever. But I think it's important to highlight that there is actually also that kind of human relationship. And again, but it's an interpretation, and others can look at the same evidence and arrive at different conclusions. That kind of goes with the hermeneutics of it all, right? That we can read the same and have different conclusions, and in a sense, both be right, right? But yeah, but I try to put it out there so also like you can read along and form your own opinions about it.
And if we then return back to Athens, beyond the Pnyx, there was also the Agora, which became the place where the new democratic institutions took physical form. So the Athenians literally had to build new spaces for democracy to take place. What were some of these new buildings that they made at the Agora?
Yeah, so we talked about the People's Assembly already, but there are other important institutions in democracy, and they are housed in and around the Agora. One of them, of course, is the Boule, the Council of 500, elected every year for a term of 1 year to sit on a council that represents Athens to foreign dignitaries who arrive, diplomats and so on. But they are also sort of a preparatory body for democracy. So they will debate various ideas for laws and decrees. And then if they agree, pass them on to the assembly for ratification or for further debate or rejection. That's also a possibility. So they're also a representative body of Athenian democracy in that those 500 people represent 50 people from each tribe in Athens. So the Athenians imagine themselves split into 10 tribes of equal size. And so they are kind of, you know, they're representing everybody in that way. So they have a bouleterion, the house where they meet. There's an archive in the Athenian Agora as well, where they keep the various documents that are important for the work of democracy. There's a house for the strategoi, for the generals. There's a tholos, a weird round building that is sort of like usually translated as a town hall of Athens. In there, members of the Britannies, were again representatives of the council, keep guard there at all hours, keep the hearth alive, and so various other institutions, including the courts, which are kind of tricky because we had difficulties identifying them in the material record properly, but we know that they're there. The courts of the democracy, which handles all kinds of cases, again with panels of judges, 201, 501, 1001 judges who will hear cases and pass a verdict.
All right. And even the ancient Athenians themselves weren't all rallying behind the banner of democracy. In fact, even prominent men like Socrates were distrustful of democracy. What were some of their criticism of the new system?
Yeah, so Socrates is maybe a little bit tricky. Well, Plato writes, puts words into the mouth of Socrates. But we know of other critics who are perhaps more direct and less subtle about their criticism. So one recurring criticism of democracy, and it shouldn't be surprising to any of your listeners because you can find that same criticism of democracy today. One criticism is that democracy is volatile and that people don't know what they're talking about, so they will make up, you know, their minds on a whim or just a gut feeling, and then the next day they will change their minds. In a sense then, that the criticism is that on the one hand, you leave important decisions in the hands of those who don't know what they're doing. People are idiots, basically.
I can't believe we still do that.
You would still hear that. But also that that there is no means of having a consistent policy because people will change their minds all the time. So those are the two sort of criticisms. And every time there's a referendum in a modern democracy, you will hear the same kind of criticism. This is very important. Why would you ask people this very, you know, this question? And so that's one thing. Another thing is, of course, that, and that's related to the question of people not understanding politics, as it were, is that there is among the elite an understanding that that they are the best and they are the best suited to rule, that it's kind of natural that they would rule. So that's an inherent sort of like baseline criticism of democracy by these people, that they are simply more fit to rule and that, that government should be in their hands. But of course, underneath all that is also a real class issue, I think, at least, in that the Athenian democracy in the 5th and 4th century, as we know it, will tax the wealthy quite harshly. They build a fleet that will be in, you know, decisive in the wars against Persia. It will build an empire for Athens. It's not a benign thing in that sense, because they will use this fleet to extract, you know, resources from all the other Greeks and kill them if they protest. But internally speaking, internally in Athenian politics, it's also a means of keeping the elite sort of in place and taxing them directly and quite harshly, to build a fleet, to pay for choral performances, to pay war taxes, and so on. So that is also a concern. And you will hear authors like Xenophon, who is a wealthy Athenian of the late 5th and early 4th century, complain that to be wealthy in Athens is actually worse than to be poor, because the democracy will take your money away.
The Athenians also had this concept of ostracism, I mean literally banishing members of their society far away. And how did this function? How would they do that?
Yeah, so that's everybody's favorite institution of ancient Greek democracy. The Athenians eventually will be a little bit afraid of themselves and the kind of monster they created, maybe in ostracism. But so ostrakon or ostraka, that's potsherds, right? So the Athenians will every year hold a vote in the assembly on whether to have an ostracism. And if they agree, and I think even there's a quorum, 6,000 must agree that there should be an ostracism, they will meet on another day, and each citizen will bring a potsherd inscribed with the name of another citizen, usually their prominent citizens, whom they wish to banish from the city for 10 years. Not kill, not expropriate their property or anything like that, just get out of here for 10 years. And then they will collect the potsherds, and the person who got the most votes will be banished for 10 years. So that's the kind of system that we think that early Athenian democracy develops, because they are still a little bit afraid of members of the elite who have great power and great sway with sections of the population. So they're always afraid, at least in the early century of democracy, they're always afraid of some of these members of the elite. On the other hand, they clearly need them for leadership, for their money and other things. So they have this sort of ambivalent relationship with these people. So they banish one person a year. They have the option of banning one person a year. They don't do this every year. And by the end of the 5th century, it seems that they simply stop. Aristotle says that even a century later, in the late 4th century, this law or the rules about ostracism, they're still on the books. You could theoretically, they will still ask the people every year, do you want to hold an ostracism? But nobody votes for it. So it kind of goes out of use, presumably then because also the members of the elite are maybe not as powerful anymore, or at least the people are not as afraid of them anymore. But it's a curious institution, especially also because we actually have quite a significant number of these potsherds that were dumped in the Kerameikos, in the necropolis of Athens. So we have a great deal of these shirts that name the politicians. And these, of course, the famous people that we know from literature, Pericles and Cimon and Hippostratos and all these. And sometimes they carry little messages. And I have those in the book as well, like little messages for, well, who are they for? Some person is going to count these shirts. The politicians who gets the vote will never see the actual vote, but there's a little message for him on it. So it's like, this person is fond of horses. That's kind of like a class criticism, like that this is this fancy rich person who has the money for horses will vote for him. And there's even one, which is my favorite, but it's frustrating in any way. It's a vote for Cimon, the famous politician from the first half of the 5th century, one of the wealthiest people in Athens, and famous also for having a sister who's outspoken. And so the potsherd is a vote for Cimon, and it says, for Cimon, go away and take your sister with you. So there you have, actually, you talked about like what kind of political influence do women have. So that's actually a little bit of a sneak peek that maybe a person like that, her name is Elpinike, that she does have some kind of influence, enough that the ordinary person in the street know of her and knows that she is maybe opinionated and basically wants to vote for her, but you can't vote for her. So he has to vote for her brother, the politician.
Sort of indirectly.
Indirectly, yeah.
But then after the 10 years, would the individuals come back? Do we have any records of
that? Yeah, then they come back and they can even probably be recalled earlier. At least that's one interpretation that Kimon is recalled himself because they need him. They need his military expertise. And there are even one person who gets ostracized twice. So
really dislike that guy. Yeah. All right. But where would they go when they were ostracized? I mean, away from Athens, yes. Where would they sort of be for that
so
period?
So members of the elite at this time in the 5th century, the early century of democracy, are really well connected. And that's actually kind of also one of the problems with the elite is that they are not as national, if I may use that anachronistic term, as the citizens at large. So they marry into other elite families in other city-states. They have property in other city-states. For Athens, especially in the 5th century, a number of the elites are with sort of like in as part of a state project are actually building little empires for themselves in the north of the Aegean in Thrace, an area that is sort of like on the periphery of the Greek world. They're carving out little kingdoms and empires for themselves. So they have plenty of places to go. So when they're ostracized, later on also politicians are not necessarily ostracized, but feel that for other reasons it would be a good time to leave Athens because things get hot around them. And one of them, for instance, is the historian Thucydides, who was also a general in the Peloponnesian War, who was in charge of a kind of a disaster and then was convicted and had to leave Athens for a period. He writes his history, or at least most of it, while he is away from Athens. So the elite has that option of going elsewhere and finding a support network elsewhere. And that is also part of what makes them dangerous to the democracy.
If we move beyond the golden age of Athenian democracy, did democracy take a backseat following Alexander the Great's conquest of Greece and beyond? Or did it, as you say, continue to sort of operate in the shadows under these new monarchies?
Well, it used to be the case that historians would think of a very sharp decline after Alexander. The idea even of the city-state was doubted. So when these new kingdoms arrive on the scene and they sort of like take up all the space on the map actually greatly expanded by this point, right? Because Alexander expands the Greek world. But it used to be thought that then democracy would disappear. Now, that was very much a view from the literature. A lot of colleagues working, again, I would tend to think of them as historians, but they're historians working with the material record of inscriptions on stone. They would have a quite different view of the ancient Greek city-state because in the Hellenistic period, what we call the epigraphic habit, meaning that you write on stone, basically, that's very much an Athenian thing in the classical period. The democracy writes a lot of stuff on stone, and so we have those inscriptions. In the Hellenistic period, that just explodes and expands to the entire Greek world. So all of a sudden, we have evidence from all corners of the Greek world, and very much of that evidence is actually evidence produced by the democratic institutions. So there are decrees, laws, and other things coming out of democracy. That is what gets written on stone. So in a sense, then, if you come from that perspective, from the material, well, we can call it the material record, but it's still like text on objects, as opposed to the literature, which is text that is transmitted through copies and copies and copies through the generation. But if you take that perspective from the epigraphy, then the Hellenistic period, the period following after Alexander's conquest, that's actually the heyday of democracy. This is where you see democracy spread to all corners of the Greek world, and you see it very active everywhere. Now, the question is, and this is something that scholars debate right now, and they have been for a while, we're still talking about this, is that democracy a quote-unquote real ancient democracy, or is it just that the institutions are kind of a shell and the wealthy have sort of like taken over and politics has now moved out of the assembly and into smoke-filled rooms, as it were, where important people decide important things. Now, that is something we're debating. And one of the problems is that for classical Athens, we have court speeches and we have historians and we have cranky philosophers and everybody's talking about democracy. So we have 2020 eyesight. Well, not 2020. We have a good idea about what's going on. We lack the same kinds of sources for the Hellenistic period. So we don't have philosophers complaining. We don't have historians, but they're then focused on the kings and the sort of like grand politics of that world, and not so much the nitty gritty of democratic politics. So it's a debate. My personal view is that it would be unfair to talk about a decline of democracy for the one reason that it simply spreads everywhere. There is again, John Maher, a colleague in Colombia, talks about a great convergence that all of the Greek world becomes democratic. So I would very much subscribe to that idea that that is the heyday of democracy. On the other hand, clearly there is something else going on. And you would think that would something else would be going on. That's like a default view of the historian, that things changes over time. If you don't believe things change over time, then maybe historian is not a good job for you. So it's more, to my mind, it's more a question of figuring out what exactly happens. You could argue that the kind of democracy that could really put the elite under their thumb that you have in at least some periods in classical Athens is not exactly the thing in the Hellenistic period. It seems to be more moderate, maybe more focused on cooperation, but that might also just be a shell. There might be beneath that serious antagonism between rich and poor. All of those things are going on. But I think the most honest thing to say is that this is something that we're working on right now. And the connection between, especially between democracy, class, gender, slavery, and so on, has not been explored very much for the Hellenistic period. This is something I would very much like to do, and I think that the time is right for it right now. So maybe like in 30 years, we should revisit that question and see what we did like with that time.
I'll call you in 30 years for the next episode about this. All right. Thank you so much, Christian. Before we end the episode, I'd love for you to summarize some of the key takeaways from what we've talked about today. I mean, what should listeners take with them after this? The floor is yours for a minute.
Oh, wow. So one thing to take away is that democracy and demokratia, our contemporary system of government and this ancient form of government, are two different things that are related in weird ways. And that makes it super exciting to study, because the ancient perspective will make you see new things about your own democracy, exactly by being close enough and related enough that we think of them as related, but also strange enough and different enough that they may offer new perspectives. I think that's the important thing to know about ancient democracy. And it's also the reason that, you know, why we need to study it, why it's important to study it.
All right. Thank you so much for that answer, Christian. And thank you for joining today's episode. It's been great having you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, dear listener, for tuning into this episode of Let's Dig Deeper. I hope you've learned lots. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us at letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that is letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss an episode. I am Zinat Haroon, and I've been your host. You can reach me on Instagram at @z_archaeology. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time, where we will dig deeper into another topic. Bye.